Merchants had borrowed heavily from investors in America and had selected the House of Morgan as sales agent for their bonds. Morgan also acted as their U.S. purchasing agent for war materials, thus profiting from both ends of the cash flow, once when the money was borrowed and again when it was spent. Further profits were derived from production contracts placed with companies within the Morgan orbit. But the war began to go badly for the Allies when Germany's submarines took virtual control of the Atlantic shipping lanes. As England and France moved closer to defeat or a negotiated peace on Germany's terms, it became increasingly difficult to sell their bonds. No bonds meant no purchases, and the Morgan cash flow was threatened. Furthermore, if the previously sold bonds should go into default, as they certainly would in the wake of defeat, the Morgan consortium would suffer gigantic losses. The only way to save the British Empire, to restore the value of the bonds, and to sustain the Morgan cash flow, was for the United States government to provide the money. But since neutral nations were prohibited from doing that by treaty, America would have to be brought into the war. A secret agreement to that effect was made between British officials and Colonel House, with the concurrence of the President. From that point forward, Wilson began to pressure Congress for a declaration of war. This was done at the very time he was campaigning for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Meanwhile, Morgan purchased control over major segments of the news media and engineered a nationwide editorial blitz against Germany, calling for war as an act of American patriotism. Morgan had created an international shipping cartel, including Germany's merchant fleet, which maintained a near monopoly on the high seas. Only the British Cunard lines remained aloof. The Lusitania was owned by Cunard and operated in competition with Morgan's cartel. The Lusitania was built to military specifications and was registered with the British Admiralty as an armed auxiliary cruiser. She carried passengers as a cover to conceal her real mission, which was to bring contraband war materials from the United States. This fact was known to Wilson and others in his administration, but they did nothing to stop it. When the German embassy tried to publish a warning to American passengers, the State Department intervened and prevented newspapers from printing it. When the Lusitania left New York Harbor on her final voyage, she was virtually a floating ammunition depot. The British knew that to draw the United States into the war would mean the difference between defeat and victory, and anything that could accomplish that was proper. Even the coldly calculated sacrifice of one of her great ships with Englishmen aboard. But the trick was to have Americans on board also, in order to create the proper emotional climate in the United States. As the Lusitania moved into hostile waters where a German U-boat was known to be operating, First Lord of the Admiralty Winston Churchill ordered her destroyer protection to abandon her. This, plus the fact that she had been ordered to travel at reduced speed, made her an easy target. After the impact of one well-placed torpedo, a mighty second explosion from within ripped her apart, and the ship that many believed could not be sunk gurgled to the bottom in less than 18 minutes. The deed had been done, and it set in motion great waves of revulsion against the Germans. These waves eventually flooded through Washington and swept the United States into war. Within days of the declaration, Congress voted $1 billion in credit for England and France. $200 million was sent to England immediately and was applied to the Morgan account. The vast quantity of money needed to finance the war was created by the Federal Reserve System, which means it was collected from Americans through that hidden tax called inflation. Within just 5 years, this tax had taken fully one-half of all they had saved. The infinitely higher cost in American blood was added to the bill. Thus it was that the separate motives of such diverse personalities as Winston Churchill, J.P. Morgan, Colonel House, and Woodrow Wilson all found common cause in bringing America into World War I. Churchill maneuvered for military advantage, Morgan sought the profits of war. House schemed for political power. And Wilson dreamed of a chance to dominate a post-war League of Nations. Chapter 13. Masquerade in Moscow. The secret society founded by Cecil Rhodes for the purpose of world dominion. The establishment in America of a branch of that group called the Council on Foreign Relations. The role played by financiers within these groups in financing the Russian Revolution. The use of the Red Cross mission in Moscow as a cover for that maneuver. One of the greatest myths of contemporary history is that the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia was a popular uprising of the downtrodden masses against the hated ruling class of the Tsars. As we shall see, however, the planning, the leadership, and especially the financing came entirely from outside Russia, mostly from financiers in Germany, Britain, and the United States. Furthermore, we shall see that the Rothschild formula played a major role in shaping these events. This amazing story begins with the war between Russia and Japan in 1904. Jacob Schiff, who was head of the New York investment firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, had raised the capital for large war loans to Japan. It was due to this funding that the Japanese were able to launch a stunning attack against the Russians at Port Arthur, and the following year to virtually decimate the Russian fleet. In 1905, the Mikado awarded Jacob Schiff a medal, the Second Order of the Treasure of Japan, in recognition of his important role in that campaign. During the 2 years of hostilities, thousands of Russian soldiers and sailors were taken as prisoners. Sources outside of Russia which were hostile to the Tsarist regime paid for the printing of Marxist propaganda and had it delivered to the prison camps. Russian-speaking revolutionaries were trained in New York and sent to distribute the pamphlets among the prisoners and to indoctrinate them into rebellion against their own government. When the war was ended, these officers and enlisted men returned home to become virtual seeds of treason against the Tsar. They were to play a major role a few years later in creating mutiny among the military during the communist takeover of Russia. Trotsky was a multiple agent. One of the best-known Russian revolutionaries at that time was Leon Trotsky. In January of 1916, Trotsky was expelled from France and came to the United States. It has been claimed that his expenses were paid by Jacob Schiff. There is no documentation to substantiate that claim, but the circumstantial evidence does point to a wealthy donor in New York. He remained for several months while writing for a Russian socialist paper, the Novy Mir, New World, and giving revolutionary speeches at mass meetings in New York City. According to Trotsky himself, on many occasions a chauffeured limousine was placed at his service by a wealthy friend identified as Dr. M. In his book, My Life, Trotsky wrote, "The doctor's wife took my wife and the boys out driving and was very kind to them. But she was a mere mortal, whereas the chauffeur was a magician, a titan, a superman. With the wave of his hand, he made the machine obey his slightest command. To sit beside him was the supreme delight. When they went into a tea room, the boys would anxiously demand of their mother, 'Why doesn't the chauffeur come in?'" It must have been a curious sight to see the family of the great socialist radical, defender of the working class, enemy of capitalism, enjoying the pleasures of tea rooms and chauffeurs, the very symbols of capitalist luxury. On March 23, 1917, a mass meeting was held at Carnegie Hall to celebrate the abdication of Nicholas II, which meant the overthrow of Tsarist rule in Russia. Thousands of socialists, Marxists, nihilists, and anarchists attended to cheer the event. The following day, there was published on page 2 of the New York Times a telegram from Jacob Schiff, which had been read to this audience. He expressed regrets that he could not attend, and then described the successful Russian Revolution as what we had hoped and striven for these long years. In the February 3, 1949 issue of the New York Journal American, Schiff's grandson, John, was quoted by columnist Charlie Knickerbocker as saying that his grandfather had given about $20 million for the triumph of communism in Russia. When Trotsky returned to Petrograd in May of 1917 to organize the Bolshevik phase of the Russian Revolution, he carried $10,000 for travel expenses, a generously ample fund considering the value of the dollar at that time. The amount is known with certainty because Trotsky was arrested by Canadian and British naval personnel when the ship on which he was traveling, the SS Christianafjord, put in at Halifax. The money in his possession is now a matter of official record. The source of that money has been the focus of much speculation, but the evidence strongly suggests that its origin was the German government. It was a sound investment. Trotsky was not arrested on a whim. He was recognized as a threat to the best interests of England, Canada's mother country in the British Commonwealth. Russia was an ally of England in the First World War, which then was raging in Europe. Anything that would weaken Russia, and that certainly included internal revolution, would be, in effect, to strengthen Germany and weaken England. In New York, on the night before his departure, Trotsky had given a speech in which he said, "I am going back to Russia to overthrow the provisional government and stop the war with Germany." Trotsky, therefore, represented a real threat to England's war effort. He was arrested as a German agent and taken as a prisoner of war. With this in mind, we can appreciate the great strength of those mysterious forces, both in England and the United States, that intervened on Trotsky's behalf. Immediately, telegrams began to come into Halifax from such divergent sources as an obscure attorney in New York City, from the Canadian Deputy Postmaster General, and even from a high-ranking British military officer, all inquiring into Trotsky's situation and urging his immediate release. The head of the British Secret Service in America at that time was Sir William Weissman, who, as fate would have it, occupied the apartment directly above the apartment of Edward Mandell House, and who had become fast friends with him. House advised Weissman that President Wilson wished to have Trotsky released. Weissman advised his government, and the British Admiralty issued orders on April 21st that Trotsky was to be sent on his way. It was a fateful decision that would affect not only the outcome of war, but the future of the entire world. It would be a mistake to conclude that Jacob Schiff and Germany were the only players in this drama. Trotsky could not have gone even as far as Halifax without having been granted an American passport, and this was accomplished by the personal intervention of President Wilson. Professor Anthony Sutton says, "President Woodrow Wilson was the fairy godmother who provided Trotsky with a passport to return to Russia to carry forward the revolution." At the same time, careful State Department bureaucrats, concerned about such revolutionaries entering Russia, were unilaterally attempting to tighten up passport procedures. And there were others as well. In 1911, the St. Louis Dispatch published a cartoon by a Bolshevik named Robert Miner. Miner was later to be arrested in Tsarist Russia for revolutionary activities, and in fact was himself bankrolled by famous Wall Street financiers. Since we may safely assume that he knew his topic well, his cartoon is of great historical importance. It portrays Karl Marx, with a book entitled Socialism, under his arm, standing amid a cheering crowd on Wall Street. Gathered around and greeting him with enthusiastic handshakes are characters in silk hats, identified as John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, John D. Ryan of National City Bank, Morgan partner George W. Perkins, and Teddy Roosevelt, leader of the Progressive Party. What emerges from this sampling of events is a clear pattern of strong support for Bolshevism coming from the highest financial and political power centers in the United States, from men who supposedly were capitalists and who, according to conventional wisdom, should have been the mortal enemies of socialism and communism. Nor was this phenomenon confined to the United States. Trotsky, in his book My Life, tells of a British financier who in 1907 gave him a large loan to be repaid after the overthrow of the Tsar. Arsène de Gulevich, who witnessed the Bolshevik Revolution firsthand, has identified both the name of the financier and the amount of the loan. "In private interviews," he said, "I have been told that over 21 million rubles were spent by Lord Alfred Milner in financing the Russian Revolution. The financier just mentioned was by no means alone among the British to support the Russian Revolution with large financial donations." Another name specifically mentioned by de Gulevich was that of Sir George Buchanan, the British ambassador to Russia at the time. It was one thing for Americans to undermine Tsarist Russia and thus indirectly help Germany in the war, because Americans were not then into it. But for British citizens to do so was tantamount to treason. To understand what higher loyalty compelled these men to betray their battlefield ally and to sacrifice the blood of their own countrymen, we must take a look at the unique organization to which they belonged. The Secret Society. Lord Alfred Milner was a key figure in organizing a secret society which, at the time of these events, was about 16 years old. It was dedicated to nothing less than the quiet domination of the world. The conquest of Russia was seen as but the first phase of that plan. Since the organization is still in existence today and continues to make progress toward its goal, it is important to have its history included in this narrative. One of the most authoritative reference works on the history of this group is Tragedy and Hope by Dr. Carol Quigley. Dr. Quigley was a professor of history at Georgetown University, where President Clinton had been one of his students. He was the author of the widely used textbook Evolution of Civilization. He was a member of the editorial board of the monthly periodical Current History, and he was a frequent lecturer and consultant for such groups as the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, the Brookings Institution, the U.S. Naval Weapons Laboratory, the Naval College, the Smithsonian Institute, and the State Department. But Dr. Quigley was no mere academic. He also had been closely associated with many of the family dynasties of the super-rich. He was, by his own boast, an insider with a front-row view of the world's money power structure. When Dr. Quigley wrote his scholarly 1,300-page book of Dry History, it was not intended for the masses. It was to be read by the intellectual elite, and to that select readership he cautiously exposed one of the best-kept secrets of all time. He also made it clear, however, that he was a friendly apologist for this group, and that he supported its goals and purposes. Dr. Quigley said, "I know of the operation of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have, for much of my life, been close to it and to many of its instruments. In general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown." As mentioned, Quigley's book was intended for an elite readership composed of scholars and network insiders. But unexpectedly, it began to be quoted in the journals of the John Birch Society, which correctly had perceived that his work provided a valuable insight to the inner workings of a hidden power structure. That exposure triggered a large demand for the book by people who were opposed to the network and curious to see what an insider had to say about it. That was not according to the original plan. What happened next is best described by Quigley himself. In a personal letter dated December 9, 1975, he wrote, "Thank you for your praise of Tragedy and Hope, a book which has brought me headaches, as it apparently says something which powerful people do not want known. My publisher stopped selling it in 1968 and told me he would reprint, but in 1971 he told my lawyer that they had destroyed the plates in 1968. The rare book price went up to $135, and parts were reprinted in violation of copyright, but I could do nothing because I believed the publisher, and he would not take action even when a pirate copy of the book appeared. Only when I hired a lawyer in 1974 did I get any answers to my questions. In another personal letter, Quigley commented further on the duplicity of his publisher. They lied to me for 6 years, telling me they would reprint when they got 2,000 orders, which could never happen because they told anyone who asked that it was out of print and would not be reprinted. They denied this to me until I sent them Xerox copies of such replies in libraries, at which they told me it was a clerk's error. In other words, they lied to me but prevented me from regaining publication rights. I am now quite sure that Tragedy and Hope was suppressed. To understand why powerful people would want to suppress this book, note carefully what follows. Dr. Quigley describes the goal of this network of world financiers as nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. Each central bank, in the hands of men like Montague Norman of the Bank of England, Benjamin Strong of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, Charles Rist of the Bank of France, and Hjalmar Schacht of the Reichsbank, sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. That is the information that powerful people do not want the common man to know. Notice that Quigley refers to this group as a network. That is a precise choice of words, and it is important to an understanding of the forces of international finance. The network to which he refers is not the secret society. It is no doubt directed by it, and there are society members in key positions within the network, but we can be sure that there are many in the network who have little or no knowledge of hidden control. To explain how this can be possible, let us turn to the origin and growth of the secret society itself. Ruskin, Rhodes, and Milner. In 1870, a wealthy British socialist by the name of John Ruskin was appointed as Professor of Fine Arts at Oxford University in London. He taught that the state must take control of the means of production and organize them for the good of the community as a whole. He advocated placing control of the state into the hands of a small ruling class, perhaps even a single dictator. He said, "My continual aim has been to show the eternal superiority of some men to others, sometimes even of one man to all others." This, of course, is the same intellectual appeal of communism. Lenin taught that the masses could not be trusted to handle their own affairs, and that a special group of disciplined intellectuals must assume this role for them. That is the function of the Communist Party, which never comprises more than about 3% of the population. Even when the charade of free elections is allowed, only members of the party, or those over whom the KGB has total control, are permitted to run for office. The concept that a ruling party or class is the ideal structure for society is at the heart of all collectivist schemes, regardless of whether they are called socialism, communism, Nazism, fascism, or any other ism which may yet be invented to disguise it. It is easy, therefore, for adherents of this elitist mentality to be comfortable in almost any of these collectivist camps, a fact to which Dr. Quigley alluded when he wrote, This network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the Communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. Returning to the subject of the origins of this group, however, Dr. Quigley tells us, Ruskin spoke to the Oxford undergraduates as members of the privileged ruling class. He told them that they were the possessors of a magnificent tradition of education, beauty, rule of law, freedom, decency, and self-discipline, but that this tradition could not be saved, and did not deserve to be saved, unless it could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English masses throughout the world. Ruskin's message had a sensational impact. His inaugural lecture was copied out in longhand by one undergraduate, Cecil Rhodes, who kept it with him for 30 years. Cecil Rhodes made one of the world's greatest fortunes. With the cooperation of the Bank of England and financiers like Rothschild, he was able to establish a virtual monopoly over the diamond output of South Africa, and most of the country's gold as well. The major portion of this vast income was spent to advance the ruling class ideas of John Ruskin. Dr. Quigley explains, the Rhodes scholarships, established by the terms of Cecil Rhodes' seventh will, are known to everyone. What is not so widely known is that Rhodes, in 5 previous wills, left his fortune to form a secret society, which was to devote itself to the preservation and expansion of the British Empire. And what does not seem to be known to anyone is that this secret society was created by Rhodes and his principal trustee, Lord Milner, and continues to exist to this day. In his book on Rhodes's wills, he, Steed, who was a member of the inner circle, wrote in one place, Mr. Rhodes was more than the founder of a dynasty. He aspired to be the creator of one of those vast, semi-religious, quasi-political associations which, like the Society of Jesus, have played so large a part in the history of the world. To be more strictly accurate, he wished to found an order as the instrument of the will of the dynasty. In this secret society, Rhodes was to be leader. Steed, Brett, Lord Esher, and Milner were to form an executive committee. Arthur, Lord Balfour, Sir Harry Johnston, Lord Rothschild, Albert, Lord Grey, and others were listed as potential members of a circle of initiates, while there was to be an outer circle known as the Association of Helpers, later organized by Milner as the Round Table Organization. The pattern of conspiracy. Here, then, was the classical pattern of political conspiracy. This was the structure that made it possible for Quigley to differentiate between an international network and the secret society within that network. At the center, there is always a tiny group in complete control, with one man as undisputed leader. Next is a circle of secondary leadership that, for the most part, is unaware of an inner core. They are led to believe that they are the innermost ring. In time, as these conspiracies are built from the center out, they form additional rings of organization. Those in the outer echelons usually are idealists with an honest desire to improve the world. They never suspect an inner control for other purposes, and only those few who demonstrate a ruthless capacity for higher leadership are ever allowed to see it. After the death of Cecil Rhodes, the inner core of his secret society fell under the control of Lord Alfred Milner, Governor-General and High Commissioner of South Africa. As director of a number of public banks and as corporate precursor of England's Midland Bank, he became one of the greatest political and financial powers in the world. Milner recruited into his secret society a group of young men chiefly from Oxford and Toynbee Hall, and, according to Quigley, through his influence, these men were able to win influential posts in government and international finance and become the dominant influence in British imperial and foreign affairs up to 1939. In 1909 to 1913, they organized semi-secret groups known as Round Table Groups in the chief British dependencies and the United States. Money for the widely ramified activities of this organization came chiefly from the Rhodes Trust itself and from wealthy associates such as the Bite Brothers, from Sir Abe Bailey, and, after 1915, from the Astor family, and from foundations and firms associated with the international banking fraternity, especially the Carnegie United Kingdom Trust and other organizations associated with J.P. Morgan, the Rockefeller and Whitney families, and the associates of Lazard Brothers and of Morgan, Grenfell and Company. At the end of the war of 1914, it became clear that the organization of this system had to be greatly extended. Once again, the task was entrusted to Lionel Curtis, who established in England and each dominion a front organization to the existing local Round Table group. This front organization, called the Royal Institute of International Affairs, had as its nucleus in each area the existing submerged Round Table group. In New York, it was known as the Council on Foreign Relations, and was a front for J.P. Morgan and Company in association with the very small American Round Table Group. The Council on Foreign Relations was a spin-off from the failure of the world's leaders at the end of World War I to embrace the League of Nations as a true world government. It became clear to the master planners that they had been unrealistic in their expectations for rapid acceptance. If their plan were to be carried forward, it would have to be done on the basis of patient gradualism, symbolized by the Fabian turtle. Rose Martin says, "Colonel House was only one man, where a multitude was needed. He had set the pattern and outlined goals for the future, and he still had a scheme or two in mind. In particular, he foresaw it would be necessary for the Fabians to develop a top-level Anglo-American planning group in the field of foreign relations, which could secretly influence policy on the one hand and gradually educate public opinion on the other." To the ambitious young Fabians, British and American, who had flocked to the peace conference as economists and junior officials, it soon became evident that a new world order was not about to be produced at Paris. For them, Colonel House arranged a dinner meeting at the Hotel Majestic on May 9, 1919, together with a select group of Fabian-certified Englishmen, notably Arnold Toynbee, R. H. Tawney, and John Maynard Keynes. All were equally disillusioned, for various reasons, by the consequences of the peace. They made a gentleman's agreement to set up an organization with branches in England and America to facilitate the scientific study of international questions. As a result, two potent and closely related opinion-making bodies were founded. The English branch was called the Royal Institute of International Affairs. The American branch, first known as the Institute of International Affairs, was recognized in 1921 as the Council on Foreign Relations. It is through this front group, called the Council on Foreign Relations, and its influence over the media, tax-exempt foundations, universities, and government agencies, that the international financiers have been able to dominate the domestic and foreign policies of the United States ever since. We shall have more to say about the CFR, but our focal point for now is Great Britain, and in particular the help given to communism in Russia by Lord Alfred Milner and his web of secret societies. Round Table Agents in Russia. In Russia, prior to and during the revolution, there were many local observers, tourists, and newsmen who reported that British and American agents were everywhere, particularly in Petrograd, providing money for insurrection. One report said, for example, that British agents were seen handing out 25-ruble notes to the men at the Pavlovsky Regiment just a few hours before it mutinied against its officers and sided with the revolution. The subsequent publications of various memoirs and documents made it clear that this funding was provided by Milner and channeled through Sir George Buchanan, who was the British ambassador to Russia at that time. It was a repeat of the ploy that had worked so well for the cabal many times in the past. Roundtable members were once again working both sides of the conflict to weaken and topple a target government. Tsar Nicholas had every reason to believe that since the British were Russia's allies in the war against Germany, British officials would be the last persons on earth to conspire against him. Yet the British ambassador himself represented the hidden group which was financing the regime's downfall. The Round Table agents from America did not have the advantage of using the diplomatic service as a cover, and therefore had to be considerably more ingenious. They came not as diplomats or even as interested businessmen, but disguised as Red Cross officials on a humanitarian mission. The group consisted almost entirely of financiers, lawyers, and accountants from New York banks and investment houses. They simply had overpowered the American Red Cross organization with large contributions and, in effect, purchased a franchise to operate in its name. Professor Sutton tells us, "The 1910 Red Cross fundraising campaign for $2 million, for example, was successful only because it was supported by these wealthy residents of New York City. J.P. Morgan himself contributed $100,000. Henry P. Davison, a Morgan partner, was chairman of the 1910 New York Fundraising Committee and later became chairman of the War Council of the American Red Cross. The Red Cross was unable to cope with the demands of World War I and, in effect, was taken over by these New York bankers. For the duration of the war, the Red Cross had been made, nominally, a part of the armed forces and subject to orders from the proper military authorities. It was not clear who these authorities were, and in fact there were never any orders, but the arrangement made it possible for the participants to receive military commissions and wear the uniform of American Army officers. The entire expense of the Red Cross mission in Russia, including the purchase of uniforms, was paid for by the man who was appointed by President Wilson to become its head, Colonel William Boyce Thompson. Thompson was a classical specimen of the Round Table network. Having begun his career as a speculator in copper mines, he soon moved into the world of high finance. He refinanced the American Woolen Company and the Tobacco Products Company, launched the Cuban Cane Sugar Company, purchased controlling interest in the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company, organized the Submarine Boat Corporation and the Wright Martin Aeroplane Company, became a director of the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railway, the Magma Arizona Railroad, and the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, was one of the heaviest stockholders in the Chase National Bank, was the agent for J.P. Morgan's British securities operation, became the first full-time director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the most important bank in the Federal Reserve System, and, of course, contributed $250,000 to the Red Cross. When Thompson arrived in Russia, he made it clear that he was not your typical Red Cross representative. According to Herman Hagedorn, Thompson's biographer, he deliberately created the kind of setting which would be expected of an American magnate, established himself in a suite in the Hotel de l'Europe, bought a French limousine, went dutifully to receptions and teas, and evinced an interest in objects of art. Society and the diplomats, noting that here was a man of parts and power, began to flock about him. He was entertained at the embassies, at the houses of Kerensky's ministers. It was discovered that he was a collector, and those with antiques to sell fluttered around him, offering him miniatures, Dresden china, tapestries, even a palace or two. When Thompson attended the opera, he was given the imperial box. People on the street called him the American Tsar. And it is not surprising that, according to George Kennan, he was viewed by the Kerensky authorities as the real ambassador of the United States. It is now a matter of record that Thompson syndicated the purchase on Wall Street of Russian bonds in the amount of 10 million rubles. In addition, he gave over 2 million rubles to Alexander Kerensky for propaganda purposes inside Russia, and, with J.P. Morgan, gave the ruble equivalent of $1 million to the Bolsheviks for the spreading of revolutionary propaganda outside of Russia, particularly in Germany and Austria. An object lesson in South Africa. At first, it may seem incongruous that the Morgan Group would provide funding for both Kerensky and Lenin. These men may have both been socialist revolutionaries, but they were miles apart in their plans for the future, and, in fact, were bitter competitors for control of the new government. But the tactic of funding both sides in a political contest by then had been refined by members of the Round Table into a fine art. A stunning example of this occurred in South Africa during the outset of the Boer War in 1899. The British and Dutch had been active in the settlement of South Africa for decades. The Dutch had developed the provinces of Transvaal and the Orange Free State, while the British had colonized such areas as Rhodesia, Cape Hope, Basutoland, Swaziland, and Bechuanaland. Conflict was inevitable between these two groups of settlers whenever they found themselves in competition for the resources of the same territory, but it was the discovery of gold in the Whitewater area of the Transvaal that provided the motive for war. Politically, the Transvaal was in the hands of the Boers, who were the descendants of the Dutch settlers. But after the discovery of gold in that area, the minefields had been developed primarily by the British and became solidly under their control. Not surprisingly, one of the largest players in that game was Cecil Rhodes, who already had monopolized the diamond fields under British control to the south. Historian Henry Pike tells us, "With the discovery of gold in the Transvaal, Rhodes' greed became passionate. His hatred of Paul Kruger, the Afrikaner president of the Transvaal, knew no limits. He was bitterly opposed to Kruger's independent Transvaal and viewed this as the main obstacle to his efforts to sweep all southern Africa under British rule." In 1895, Rhodes set in motion a plan to overthrow Kruger's government by organizing an uprising among the British inhabitants in Johannesburg. The uprising was financed by himself and was to be led by his brother, Frank, and other loyal supporters. This was to be followed by a military invasion of the Transvaal by British troops from Bechuanaland and Rhodesia, led by Sir Leander Jameson. The uprising fizzled and ended in Jameson's arrest and public disgrace. But Rhodes was determined to have the Transvaal and began immediately to prepare a second, more patient ploy. Through Rhodes' influence, Lord Alfred Milner was appointed as the British High Commissioner of South Africa. In London, Lord Escher, another member of the Secret Society, became the chief political adviser to King Edward and was in daily contact with him throughout this period. That took care of the British side of this contest. With regard to the Boers' side, Professor Quigley tells the amazing story. "By a process whose details are still obscure, a brilliant young graduate of Cambridge, Jan Smuts, who had been a vigorous supporter of Rhodes and acted as his agent in Kimberley, South Africa's largest diamond mine, as late as 1895, and who was one of the most important members of the Rhodes-Milner group in the period 1908 to 1950, went to the Transvaal and, by violent anti-British agitation, became State Secretary of that country, although a British subject, and chief political adviser to President Kruger. Milner made provocative troop movements on the Boer frontiers in spite of the vigorous protests of his commanding general in South Africa, who had to be removed. And finally, war was precipitated when Smuts drew up an ultimatum insisting that the British troop movements cease, and when this was rejected by Milner. And so, as a result of careful engineering by roundtable members on both sides, one making outrageous demands and the other responding to those demands in pretended indignation, the war finally began with a British invasion in October of 1899. After 2.5 years of fierce fighting, the Boers were forced to surrender, and Milner administered the former republic as a militarily occupied territory. Roundtable members, known to the public as Milner's Kindergarten, were placed into all key government posts, and the goldfields were finally secured. Placing bets on all horses. On the other side of the world, in New York City, the same tactic of playing both sides against each other was being applied with brilliant precision by Roundtable member J.P. Morgan. Professor Quigley tells us, "To Morgan, all political parties were simply organizations to be used, and the firm always was careful to keep a foot in all camps. Morgan himself, Dwight Morrow, and other partners were allied with Republicans. Russell C. Leffingwell was allied with the Democrats. Grayson Murphy was allied with the extreme right, and Thomas W. Lamont was allied with the left." Although it is true that Thomas Lamont was the father of Corliss Lamont, a well-known communist, and was himself widely regarded as a man of leftist persuasions, it must also be remembered that he felt equally at home among the fascists, and in fact served as an unofficial business consultant for Mussolini in the 1920s. At the same time that Morgan was funding pro-Bolshevik groups, he founded what was probably the most virulent anti-Bolshevik organization ever to exist in America. It was called United Americans, and it set about to frighten everyone into believing that a red mob was at that very moment poised to capture New York City. It issued shocking reports warning about a pending financial collapse, widespread starvation, and a desperate working class being maneuvered into accepting communist slogans and rhetoric as a last resort. Ironically, the officers of this organization were Alan Walker of the Guarantee Trust Company, which was then acting as the Soviet's fiscal agent in the U.S., Daniel Willard, president of the Baltimore and Ohio Railway, which was then active in the development of Soviet railways, H.H. Westinghouse of Westinghouse Air Brake Company, which was then operating a major plant in Russia, and Otto H. Kahn of Kuhn Loeb & Company, which was one of the principal financial backers of the fledgling Soviet regime. Even inside Russia itself, the Round Table was spreading its bets. In addition to the funding previously mentioned, which was given to the Bolsheviks and to their opponents, the Mensheviks, Morgan also financed the military forces of Admiral Kolchak, who was fighting against the Bolsheviks in Siberia. Not surprisingly, Kolchak also received funding from a consortium of British financiers, including Alfred Milner. It is commonly stated that the original intent of the Red Cross mission to Moscow was to prevent the Russian government from making a separate peace with Germany, which would release German troops to fight against England and France. According to that version of the story, which portrays the actors as patriots merely doing what was best for the war effort, the first goal was to support the Tsar. When the Tsar was overthrown, they supported the Mensheviks because they had pledged to stay in the war. When the Mensheviks were ousted, they continued to support the Bolsheviks in order to gain sufficient influence to convince them not to give aid to Germany. It takes a great deal of gullibility to swallow that line. A far more plausible reading is that the Morgan interests were merely doing what they had always done, placing bets on all horses so that no matter which one crossed the finish line, the winner would be obligated to them. British agent of the Round Table. After the Bolsheviks had seized power in Russia, Sir George Buchanan was recalled as the British ambassador and replaced by a member of Milner's Kindergarten, a young man by the name of Bruce Lockhart. In his book, British Agent, Lockhart describes the circumstances of his assignment. Speaking of a meeting with Prime Minister Lloyd George, he wrote, "I saw that his own mind was made up. He had been greatly impressed, as Lord Milner told me afterwards, by an interview with Colonel Thompson of the American Red Cross, who had just returned from Russia and who had denounced in blunt language the folly of the Allies in not opening up negotiations with the Bolsheviks. 3 days later, all my doubts were put at rest. I was to go to Russia as head of a special mission to establish unofficial relations with the Bolsheviks. I had been selected for this Russian mission not by the Foreign Secretary, but by the War Cabinet, actually by Lord Milner and Mr. Lloyd George. Lord Milner I saw almost daily. 5 days before my departure, I dined alone with him at Brooks. He was in his most inspiring mood. He talked to me with a charming frankness about the war, about the future of England, about his own career, and about the opportunities of youth. He was, too, very far from being the jingo and the conservative reactionary whom popular opinion at one time represented him to be. On the contrary, many of his views on society were startlingly modern. He believed in the highly organized state, in which service, efficiency, and hard work were more important than titles or money bags. American Agent of the Round Table. When Thompson returned to the United States, the man he selected to replace himself as head of the American Red Cross mission was his second in command, Raymond Robbins. Not much is known about Robbins except that he was the protege of Colonel Edward Mandel House, and he might have remained an obscure player in this drama had it not been for the fact that he became one of the central characters in Bruce Lockhart's book. It is there that we get this inside view. Another new acquaintance of these first days in the Bolshevized St. Petersburg was Raymond Robbins, the head of the American Red Cross mission. He had been a leading figure in Roosevelt's Bull Moose campaign for the American presidency in 1912. Although a rich man himself, he was an anti-capitalist. Hitherto, his two heroes had been Roosevelt and Cecil Rhodes. Now Lenin had captured his imagination. Robbins was the only man whom Lenin was always willing to see, and who ever succeeded in imposing his own personality on the unemotional Bolshevik leader. In a less official sense, Robbins had a similar mission to my own. He was the intermediary between the Bolsheviks and the American government, and had set himself the task of persuading President Wilson to recognize the Soviet regime. What an amazing revelation is contained in those words. First, we learn that Robbins was a leader in the team effort that threw the election of 1912 to Woodrow Wilson. Then we learn that he was an anti-capitalist. Third, we discover that an anti-capitalist can hero-worship Cecil Rhodes. Then we see the tremendous power he wielded over Lenin. And finally, we are told that although he was part of a private group financed by Wall Street bankers, he was in reality the intermediary between the Bolsheviks and the American government. One will look in vain for a better summary. The fact that Cecil Rhodes was one of Robbins' great heroes has special significance for this story. It was not merely an intellectual infatuation from college days. On the night before he left Russia, Robbins dined with Lockhart. Describing the occasion, Lockhart says, "He had been reading Rhodes' life, and after dinner he gave us a wonderful exposition of Rhodes' character." Thus, both Lockhart and Robbins were dedicated disciples of Cecil Rhodes, and both were undoubtedly part of the international network to which Professor Quigley alluded, possibly even members of the Round Table. Lockhart reported to the British group while Robbins reported to the American group, but both were clearly working for identical objectives and doing the work of the unseen hand. The Bolsheviks were well aware of the power these men represented, and there was no door closed to them. They were allowed to attend meetings of the Central Executive Committee and were consulted regarding important decisions. But perhaps the best way to appraise the extent of the influence these capitalists had over the anti-capitalists is to let Lockhart tell his own story. In his memoirs, he wrote, "I returned from our interview to our flat to find an urgent message from Robbins requesting me to come to see him at once. I found him in a state of great agitation. He had been in conflict with Salkind, a nephew of Trotsky, and then assistant commissar for foreign affairs. Salkind had been rude, and the American, who had a promise from Lenin that whatever happened, a train would always be ready for him at an hour's notice, was determined to exact an apology or to leave the country. When I arrived, he had just finished telephoning to Lenin. He had delivered his ultimatum and Lennon had promised to give a reply within 10 minutes. I waited while Robbins fumed. Then the telephone rang, and Robbins picked up the receiver. Lennon had capitulated. Salkind was dismissed from his post. But he was an old member of the party. Would Robbins have any objection if Lenin sent him as a Bolshevik emissary to Bern? Robbins smiled grimly. "Thank you, Mr. Lenin," he said. "As I can't send the son of a bitch to hell, Bern is the next best thing you can do with him." Such was the raw power over the leaders of communism that was concealed behind the innocent facade of the American Red Cross mission. And yet the world, even today, has no inkling of its reality. It has been a carefully guarded secret, and even many of those who were close to it were unable to see it. The assistant to William Thompson in Russia was Cornelius Kelleher. In later years, reflecting on the naivete of Dr. Franklin Billings, who was head of the mission's medical team, Kelleher wrote, "Poor Mr. Billings believed he was in charge of a scientific mission for the relief of Russia. He was, in reality, nothing but a mask. The Red Cross complexion of the mission was nothing but a mask." The purpose of a mask, of course, is to conceal. And so we are led to ask the question, what was behind that mask? What were the true motives and goals of the masqueraders? We shall turn to that subject next. Summary. The Bolshevik Revolution was not a spontaneous uprising of the masses. It was planned, financed, and orchestrated by outsiders. Some of the financing came from Germany, which hoped that internal problems would force Russia out of the war against her. But most of the money and leadership came from financiers in England and the United States. It was a perfect example of the Rothschild formula in action. This group centered mainly around a secret society created by Cecil Rhodes, one of the world's wealthiest men at the time. The purpose of that group was nothing less than world dominion and the establishment of a modern feudalist society controlled by the world's central banks. Headquartered in England, the Rhodes' innermost directorate was called the Round Table. In other countries, there were established subordinate structures called Round Table Groups. The Round Table Group in the United States became known as the Council on Foreign Relations. The CFR, which was initially dominated by J.P. Morgan and later by the Rockefellers, is the most powerful group in America today. It is even more powerful than the federal government, because almost all of the key positions in government are held by its members. In other words, it is the United States government. Agents of these two groups cooperated closely in pre-revolutionary Russia, and particularly after the Tsar was overthrown. The American contingent in Russia disguised itself as a Red Cross mission, allegedly doing humanitarian work. Cashing in on their close friendship with Trotsky and Lenin, they obtained profitable business concessions from the new government, which returned their initial investment many times over.
You have reached the end of Disc 10.
Chapter 14. The Best Enemy Money Can Buy. The coup d'etat in Russia, in which the Bolshevik minority seized control from the revolutionary majority. The role played by New York financiers, masquerading as Red Cross officials, in supporting the Bolsheviks. The unbroken record since then of American assistance in building Russia's war-making potential. The emergence of a credible enemy in accordance with the Rothschild formula. In the previous section, we saw that the Red Cross mission in revolutionary Russia was, in the words of its own personnel, nothing but a mask. This leads to the logical question, what were the true motives and goals that were hidden behind that mask? In later years, it would be explained by the participants themselves that they simply were engaged in a humanitarian effort to keep Russia in the war against Germany, and thus to help the cause of freedom for England and her allies. For Jacob Schiff and other Jewish financiers in New York, there was the additional explanation that they opposed the Tsar because of his anti-Semitism. These, of course, are admirable motives, and they have been uncritically accepted by mainstream historians ever since. Unfortunately, the official explanations do not square with the facts. Russia's two revolutions. The facts are that there were two revolutions in Russia that year, not one. The first, called the February Revolution,